It's the second Sunday of Advent, so we have two candles lit beneath me, and in Advent, our readings flip between looking back to the first coming of Jesus as a baby and looking forwards to the second coming of Jesus. Except this reading might just add a level of confusion, because although it's in the past, this reading comes from Isaiah, which I guess was written probably about 2,800 years ago. So it's before the first coming. It's actually looking forwards to the second coming, if that doesn't confuse. So if you can hold that in your mind, we're looking forwards with a reading from the past. It's a prophecy about Jesus, and there are many prophecies in the Old Testament. Some scholars suggest as many as 300. Why is this important? Well, whether or not it's 300, there are many. And the fact that there are many reminds us that God has had then and has now a plan. He planned what would happen with Jesus from the beginning of time. And what will happen with Jesus will come to fulfillment. And I think you will find today that that will be really, really encouraging for all of us to remember that God has a plan. So let's have a look at the book of Isaiah. A bit of an introduction first. It was a vision that was given to this prophet during a particular time. Chapter 1 and verse 1. Defines this vision. During the reign of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. I bet you're pleased, Brian, I didn't give you that reading this morning. Now, that period of time is about 8 to 7 centuries before Jesus. These kings really existed. They were kings of what we now know as Israel. Now, Uzziah reigned the longest, and during a period of prosperity for Israel and Judah. If you think geographically for a moment, Israel and Judah were sitting at a very strategic point between Africa and what we now know as the Middle East. So they were on a very important trade route, and they made the most of that. It's a bit like the equivalent of kind of Felixstowe today, really. So they did very well out of trade. And at the same time, their nearest superpower neighbour, Assyria, which was on their northern boundary, was preoccupied with its own issues, with its own neighbours. So it kind of left Israel and Judah, this tiny little country, alone. And so it prospered. Now, sadly, under the next three kings, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, the land was to lurch from crisis to crisis as a resurgent and battle-hungry superpower, Assyria, flexed its muscle. It economically crippled Israel and Judah through a system of tributes. It basically said, look, I'm not going to invade, but you need to pay money to prevent me from invading. And also, you need to acknowledge my gods. Now, that was beyond the pale for most or for many people who were not prepared to compromise. And one of those people who wasn't prepared to compromise was King Hezekiah. And so what he did was to gamble on help from Egypt, which wasn't a very good gamble to make because Egypt wasn't very powerful at the time, and strengthening his own defenses. But none of this paid off, and he discovered in the middle of his reign Assyria under the king Sennacherib, another interesting name, mounting its forces on his borders. And they were about to be annihilated. It was a bit like today if Russia decided that it really wanted Estonia back or Latvia. I mean, within a few hours, they'd have the country in their control. It was only the intervention of God that we read about in chapter 37 of Isaiah that prevented a massacre by the Assyrian army. And in the midst of all this military and political turmoil, we meet the prophet Isaiah, who consistently spoke truth to power for the reign of not one but four kings. my mind at this point turns to our own Queen, who has spoken truth to power in our own country, not to other kings and queens, but to prime ministers, 14 in total, in a quiet, godly, wise way. Now, Isaiah had an encounter with God in chapter 6. You might have read it, you'll certainly remember it. It was a time when Isaiah encountered God in the temple, and he actually had a vision of God, high and exalted. And God sent an angel to come and to forgive him his sins. And that encounter with God utterly turned his life around and shaped everything that he said from there on. And it gave him great confidence. Because having had that encounter with God, who was sovereign and in charge, he wasn't afraid of the Syrians. Even though they were mounting their forces on the borders of his country, he knew that God would prevail. And so whilst the kings that he spoke to, King Ahaz and King Hezekiah, struggled to trust in God when they should have been trusting in God, and whilst Sennacherib mocked Isaiah's trust in God as madness, Isaiah believed God was in control, that he had a plan. It's an interesting question for us to reflect on in our own times of political controversy and turmoil. We don't have Assyria at the gates, but we have a resurgent Russia and China flexing their muscles. Our own parliament seems deadlocked. And we have an election in a few days' time, which we probably wonder, will it make any difference? An interesting question. Interesting times. Do we trust in the providence of God in all of this, as Isaiah trusted in God? Now, we know very little about Isaiah the man, but we know lots about what he said. And as I've said, this vision breaks into a period of history that is very turbulent. Battles are won and lost, kingdoms rise and fall, the world is a very dangerous and unstable place. And the ordinary people, the ones on universal credit, who are struggling to survive and make sense of their lives in times of constant change, are faced with intense, threatening, and confusing lives. And it's into this context that we hear the words of Isaiah. Chapter 1 and verse 2. Hear, O heavens, listen, O earth, for the Lord has spoken. You see, the vision breaks into history to expose its true shape, character, and goal. It literally draws back the curtain, this vision of Isaiah, and shows us that in history, with all its confusing particularities, there is a stage, nevertheless. The history is a stage on which a great drama is played out. But the drama is scripted and directed at every turn by God himself. So if you read the whole of the book of Isaiah, and I commend it to you, it's not an easy read, but it's a worthwhile read. You'll read that Assyria, the enemy of Israel and Judah, is used by God as the rod of his anger. You'll read about the sufferings that God's people experienced in exile in Babylon. By the waters of Babylon, we sat down and wept, as one group put it. But they are a furnace in which God is going to revive and refine his people. And when you get to the end of Isaiah, as you do, chapter 65, you come to a fantastic picture, a picture of a new city and a new universe. You see, for Isaiah, history has got meaning because it is God taking history somewhere. History is his story. And what the vision of Isaiah does is to set the end firmly before us and ask us to live in the light of this confidence. Because if you know where you're going and where things are heading, it changes radically how you live. So this vision has a very sharp focus. Remember the last time you were at the theatre? At the end of the play, the curtain comes down and then perhaps rises again, and the cast come to take their bow. And first of all, it's the minor parts. They come centre stage and then they move to the sides. And then the medium sort of size parts come in and then they move to the side. And you're left with a gap in the middle. And the leading actor and actress come forwards and they take their bow. And everybody else follows them. The figure who comes into centre stage in Isaiah's vision has royal titles which link him with the very God himself. Chapter 9, we read, "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, and Prince of Peace." This is the one who is center stage in Isaiah's vision. Remember, this is 700 years before Jesus comes. But it is clear as mustard in Isaiah's mind that this will happen. He is the shoot from the stump of Jesse, an ideal king from the line of David himself, Jesse being King David's father. He is endowed, we're told, with a spirit of wisdom, and he rules with perfect justice. Now let's look at those verses a moment. But before we do that, we need to glance ahead, because I want to give you the full picture of the book of Isaiah. So it's the only time we'll look at it this Christmas time, really, apart from a brief look at our carols next week. We need to understand this small few verses in the context of the whole. Because not only do we have a picture of one who is Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace, but if you read through the book of Isaiah, you must see, and you will see, how this figure at the center of the stage also changes. It's like looking at the main actor on stage changing before your very eyes in a particularly shocking way. We read later in Isaiah that this act, this center stage, is a very humble and a gentle servant. Yes, he's described as the Wonderful Counselor, the Prince of Peace. But he is also a gentle servant, one who meets discouragement and opposition in chapter 49, one who is eventually persecuted and killed in chapter 53, but one who is then raised to life, to glory, becoming once again the king we saw before. And so this Jesus goes through all the suffering in his own person. Not by making other people suffer, which is mostly what kings tend to do. Certainly in the past they did. No, he suffers himself in order that forgiveness and hope might be offered to humankind for the whole of history. And so a few words about our passage for today. We read about a stump, the stump of Jesse. Now, a stump is what's left when a tree is cut down. And interestingly, if you look at the verses just before this passage in chapter 10, right at the end there, verses 33 and 34, you see some other chopping down going on. The Lord Almighty will lop off the boughs with great power. Lofty trees will be felled, tall ones brought low. Lebanon will fall before the Mighty One. Well, this is a reminder, a prophecy, that Assyria, the superpower itself, will fall. It was once the greatest power in the whole world. But by 600 BC, within 100 years, it had ceased to exist. The Roman Empire was once the greatest power in the world. Where is it now? Currently, where are our superpowers? Russia? China? United States? You see, one day they will all cease to exist, because there is one who is more powerful than all of them put together. So that forest is felled. And now we see the emergence of a shoot from a stump. Syria is felled never to grow again. But Judah was chastened. It was cut down in punishment by God. It was punished by God. But now a shoot is coming up from that stump. A stump indicates the humble origin of this leader. I mean, tree stumps are not much to look at, are they? They're just what's left behind. This leader bypassed all the ostentation of a palace and a kingly court to be born in a wooden manger. His qualification to rule will be because he is full of the Spirit, as we read here. He is full of wisdom and understanding, grounded in a fear of the Lord. Remember our study of the book of Proverbs. Other kings before him had failed because they feared the powers of armies surrounding them rather than trusting in God. Other kings failed because they judged what they saw with their eyes, the size of chariots and tanks and armies, and by what they heard in their ears, the propaganda, the fake news. No, this king trusts in the one and fears the one in whom it is only right to fear. And this king will come from the root of the stump. It will shoot from the stump. But it also, we're told, be a root. Now, how can you both be a shoot and a root? It doesn't make sense. I'm not much of a gardener, but I don't think you can both be a root and a shoot. What's it getting on about? It's saying that in the sense that Jesus is the shoot from the stump, he is coming from the line of David. Jesse, David's father. He's coming from that kingly line, which is very important for the Jewish people. But in the sense that he is the root, he's actually before that kingly line. He actually created the kingly line. Jesus is before all things. In him all things hold together, we're told. So the shoot means that he's not just another king. He is the king. And the fundamental characteristic of his rule will be righteousness, which in practical terms means justice for the poor and the meek, which was something earlier kings had failed to do. Counsel and might are given to him, and they're all to do with being able to devise the right course of action and to see it through. Gosh, don't we need to pray that for our political leaders today? And he will be able to execute perfect justice because he will have perfect knowledge. Perfect justice can only take place when you have all the facts. We know that there are many miscarriages of justice, and they often come about because we discover facts later that we didn't know at the time. And so things have to be appealed and rewritten, and people get released rightly. You see, this person will have perfect knowledge, so he will judge people perfectly. And the effect of his rule will be a universal peace, an ideal that is described here in symbolic language, like the paradise of Eden. Just look at it for a few minutes with me now. There will be no more wrongdoing or marring of what is good. Old hostilities will be reconciled. There will be a change of nature in creation. I mean, where do you see cows and bears eating from the same food today? Where do you see little babies sitting next to the snakes freely? course, these are pictures. But beneath the picture, there is a profound symbolism here of all things being made new. The whole earth will be God's mountain. All people, we're told, will have the knowledge of God. And the picture of water covering the sea is not a throwback to the flood, which was judgment, but just a symbol of the fact that as water covers everything, the knowledge of God will be known by all. So in this passage, as in chapter 9, Isaiah looks beyond the disappointments of his own age to the coming of the one who can only be God in the flesh, Jesus Christ. Chapter 9 teaches about his first coming, his birth, and this chapter, his second coming, when all this will be fulfilled. This leader certainly gets my vote.